ISIS Audiobooks presents an unabridged recording of The Last Hero, written by Terry Pratchett, read by Stephen Briggs. The place where the story happened was a world on the back of four elephants perched on the shell of a giant turtle. That's the advantage of space. It's big enough to hold practically anything, and so, eventually, it does. People think that it is strange to have a turtle 10,000 miles long, and an elephant more than 2,000 miles tall, which just shows that the human brain is ill-adapted for thinking and was probably originally designed for cooling the blood. It believes mere size is amazing. There's nothing amazing about size. Turtles are amazing, and elephants are quite astonishing. But the fact that there's a big turtle is far less amazing than the fact that there is a turtle anywhere. The reason for the story was a mix of many things. There was humanity's desire to do forbidden deeds merely because they were forbidden. There was its desire to find new horizons and kill the people who lived beyond them. There were the mysterious scrolls. There was the cucumber. But mostly there was the knowledge that one day, quite soon, it would be all over. Ah, well, life goes on, people say when someone dies. But from the point of view of the person who has just died, it doesn't. It's the universe that goes on. Just as the deceased was getting the hang of everything, it's all whisked away by illness or accident, or, in one case, a cucumber. Why this has to be is one of the imponderables of life, in the face of which people either start to pray or become really, really angry. The beginning of the story happened tens of thousands of years ago, on a wild and stormy night, when a speck of flame came down the mountain at the centre of the world. It moved in dodges and jerks, as if the unseen person carrying it was sliding and falling from rock to rock. At one point, the line became a streak of sparks, ending in a snowdrift at the bottom of a crevasse. But a hand, thrust up through the snow, held the smoking embers of the torch, and the wind, driven by the anger of the gods, and with a sense of humour of its own, whipped the flame back into life. And after that, it never died. The end of the story began high above the world, but got lower and lower as it circled down towards the ancient and modern city of Ankh-Morpork, where it was said anything could be bought and sold, and if they didn't have what you wanted, they could steal it for you. Some of them could even dream it. The creature, now seeking out a particular building below, was a trained, pointless albatross, and by the standards of the world, was not particularly unusual, compared to, say, the Republican bees, who committed rather than swarmed, and tended to stay in the hive a lot, voting for more honey. It was, though, pointless. It spent its entire life in a series of lazy journeys between the rim and the hub. And where was the point in that? This one was more or less tame. Its beady, mad eye spotted where, for reasons entirely beyond its comprehension, anchovies could be found. And someone would remove this uncomfortable cylinder from its leg. It seemed a pretty good deal to the albatross, and from this it can be deduced that these albatrosses are, if not completely pointless, at least rather dumb. Not at all like humans, therefore. Flight has been said to be one of the great dreams of mankind. In fact, it merely harks back to man's ancestors, whose greatest dream was of falling off the branch. In any case, other great dreams of mankind have included the one about being chased by huge boots with teeth, and no one says that one has to make sense. 3 busy hours later, Lord Vetinari, the patrician of Ankh-Morpork, was standing in the main hall of Unseen University, and he was impressed. The wizards, once they understood the urgency of a problem, and then had lunch, and argued about the pudding, could actually work quite fast. Their method of finding a solution, as far as the patrician could see, was by creative hubbub. If the question was, what is the best spell for turning a book of poetry into a frog, then the one thing they would not do was look in any book with a title like Major Amphibian Spells in a Literary Environment, a comparison. That would somehow be cheating. They would argue about it instead, standing around a blackboard, seizing the chalk from one another, and rubbing out bits of what the current chalk holder was writing before he'd finished the other end of the sentence. Somehow, though, it all seemed to work. Now, something stood in the centre of the hall. It looked, to the arts-educated patrician, like a big magnifying glass surrounded by rubbish.
"Technically, my lord, an omniscope can see anywhere," said Arch-Chancellor Ridcully, who was head of all known wizardry. That is, all those wizards who knew Arch-Chancellor Ridcully and were prepared to be led.
"Anywhere. Remarkable," said the patrician.
"Anywhere and any time," Ridcully went on,
apparently not impressed himself. "How extremely useful."
"Yes, everyone says that," said Ridcully, kicking the floor morosely. "The trouble is, because the blasted thing can see everywhere, it's practically impossible to get it to see anywhere, at least anywhere worth seeing. And you'd be amazed at how many places there are in the universe, and times, too."
20 past 1, for example, said the patrician.
"Among others, indeed. Would you care to have a look, my lord?"
Lord Veterinary advanced cautiously and peered into the big round glass. He frowned. "All I can see is what's on the other side of it," he said.
"Ah, that's because it's set to here and now, sir," said a young wizard who was still adjusting the device.
"Oh, I see," said the patrician. "We have these at the palace, in fact. We call them windows."
"Well, if I do this," said the wizard,
and did something to the rim of the glass,
"it looks the other way."
Lord Veterinary looked into his own face. "And these we call mirrors," he said, as if explaining to a child.
I think not, sir," said the wizard. "It takes a moment to realise what you're seeing. It helps if you hold up your hand."
Lord Veterinary gave him a severe look, but essayed a little wave.
"Oh, how curious. What is your name, young man?"
"Ponder Stibbons, sir. The new head of Inadvisably Applied Magic, sir. You see, sir, the trick isn't to build an omniscope, because, after all, that's just a development of the old-fashioned crystal ball. It's to get it to see what you want. It's like tuning a string, and if—"
"Sorry, what applied magic?" said the patrician.
Inadvisably, sir," said Ponder smoothly,
as if hoping that he could avoid the problem by driving straight through it.
"Anyway, I think we can get it to the right area, sir. The power drain is considerable. We may have to sacrifice another gerbil."
The wizards began to gather around the device. "Can you see into the future?" said Lord Veterinary.
In theory, yes, sir," said Ponder. "But that would be highly, inadvisable, you see, because initial studies would indicate that the fact of observation would collapse the waveform in phase space."
Not a muscle moved on the patrician's face.
"Pardon me, I'm a little out of date on faculty staff," he said. "Are you the one who has to take dried frog pills?"
No, sir, that's the bursar, sir," said Ponder. "He has to have them because he's insane, sir."
"Ah," said Lord Veterinary, and now he did have an expression. It was that of a man resolutely refraining from saying what was on his mind.
"What Mr. Stibbons means, my lord," said the Arch-Chancellor, "is that there are billions and billions of futures that sort of exist, do you see? They're all the possible shapes of the future. But apparently the first one you actually look at is the one that becomes the future. It might not be the one you'd like. Apparently it's all to do with the uncertainty principle."
"And that is?"
I'm not sure. Mr. Stibbons is the one who knows about that sort of thing."
An orangutan ambled past, carrying an extremely large number of books under each arm.
Lord Veterinary looked at the hoses that snaked from the omniscope and out through the open door and across the lawn to, what was it, the high-energy magic building? He remembered the old days, when wizards had been gaunt and edgy and full of guile. They wouldn't have allowed an uncertainty principle to exist for any length of time. If you weren't certain, they'd say, what were you doing wrong? What you were uncertain of could kill you. The omniscope flickered and showed a snowfield with black mountains in the distance. The wizard called Ponder Stibbons appeared to be very pleased with this. "I thought you said you could find him with this thing," said Veterinari to the Arch-Chancellor. Ponder Stibbons looked up.
Do we have something that he has owned? Some personal item he has left lying around?" he said. "We could put it in the morphic resonator, connect that up to the omniscope, and it'll home in on him like a shot."
"Whatever happened to the magic circles and dribbly candles?" said Lord Veterinari.
They're for when we're not in a hurry, sir," said Ponder.
"Cohen the Barbarian is not known for leaving things lying around, I fear," said the patrician. "Bodies, perhaps. All we know is that he is heading for Corri Celesti."
"The mountain at the hub of the world, sir? Why?"
"I was hoping you would tell me, Mr. Stibbons. That is why I'm here." The librarian ambled past again with another load of books. Another response of the wizards when faced with a new and unique situation was to look through their libraries to see if it had ever happened before. This was, Lord Veterinari reflected, a good survival trait. It meant that, in times of danger, you spent the day sitting very quietly in a building with very thick walls. He looked again at the piece of paper in his hand. Why were people so stupid? One sentence caught his eye. "He says the last hero ought to return what the first hero stole." And, of course, everyone knew what the first hero stole. The gods play games with the fate of men. Not complex ones, obviously, because gods lack patience. Cheating is part of the rules, and gods play hard. To lose all believers is, for a god, the end. But a believer who survives the game gains honour and extra belief. Who wins with the most believers lives. Believers can include other gods, of course. Gods believe in belief. There were always many games going on in Dun Manifestin, the abode of the gods on Corri Celesti. It looked, from outside, like a crowded city. A few religions are definite about the size of heaven, but on the planet Earth, the Book of Revelation, chapter 21, verse 16, gives it as a cube 12,000 furlongs on a side. This is somewhat smaller than 5 trillion cubic feet. Even allowing that the heavenly host and other essential services take up at least 2/3 of this space, this leaves about 1 million cubic feet of space for each human occupant, assuming that every creature that could be called human is allowed in, and that the human race eventually totals 1,000 times the number of humans alive up until now. This is such a generous amount of space that it suggests that room has also been provided for some alien races, or, a happy thought, that pets are allowed. As for Dun Manifestin, not all gods lived there, many of them being bound to a particular country, or, in the case of the smaller ones, even one tree. But it was a good address. It was where you hung your metaphysical equivalent of the shiny brass plate, like those small, discreet buildings in the smarter areas of major cities, which nevertheless appear to house 150 lawyers and accountants, presumably on some sort of shelving. The city's domestic appearance was because, while people are influenced by gods, so gods are influenced by people. Most gods were people-shaped. People didn't have much imagination on the whole. Even Offler the crocodile god was only crocodile-headed. Ask people to imagine an animal god, and they will, basically, come up with the idea of someone in a really bad mask. Men have been much better at inventing demons, which is why there are so many. Above the wheel of the world, the gods played on. They sometimes forgot what happened if you let a pawn get all the way up the board. It took a little longer for the rumour to spread around the city, but in twos and threes the leaders of the great guilds hurried into the university. Then the ambassadors picked up the news. Around the city, the big semaphore towers faltered in their endless task of exporting market prices to the world, sent the signal to clear the line for high-priority emergency traffic, and then clacked the little packets of doom to chancelleries and castles across the continent. They were in code, of course. If you have news about the end of the world, you don't want everyone to know. Lord Vetinari stared along the table. "If I may recap, then, ladies and gentlemen," he said as the hubbub died away, "according to the authorities in Hong Kong, the capital of the Agatian Empire, the Emperor Genghis Cohen, formerly known to the world as Cohen the Barbarian, is well en route to the home of the gods with a device of considerable destructive power and the intention, apparently, of, in his words, returning what was stolen. And in short, they ask us to stop him."
"Why us?" said Mr. Boggis, head of the Thieves' Guild. "He's not our emperor."
"I understand the Agatian government believes us to be capable of anything," said Lord Vetinari. "We have zip, zing, vim, and a go-getting can-do attitude."
"Can-do what?"
Lord Vetinari shrugged. "In this case, save the world."
"But we'll have to save it for everyone, right?" said Mr. Boggis. "Even foreigners?"
"Well, yes. You cannot just save the bits you like," said Lord Vetinari. "But the thing about saving the world, gentlemen and ladies, is that it inevitably includes whatever you happen to be standing on. So let us move forward. Can magic help us, Arch-Chancellor?"
"No, nothing magical can get within 100 miles of the mountains," said the Arch-Chancellor.
"Why not?"
"For the same reason you can't sail a boat into a hurricane. There's just too much magic. It overloads anything magical. A magic carpet would unravel in mid-air."
Or turn into broccoli," said the Dean, "or a small volume of poetry."
"Are you saying that we cannot get there in time?"
Well, yes, exactly. Of course, they're already near the base of the mountain."
And heroes,
said Mr. Betteridge of the Guild of Historians. "And that means exactly," said the patrician, sighing.
They're good at doing what they want to do."
"But they are also, as I understand it, very old men."
Very old heroes, the historian corrected him. "That just means they've had a lot of experience in doing what they want to do."
Lord Vetinari sighed again. He did not like to live in a world of heroes. You had civilization such as it was, and you had heroes. "What exactly has Cohen the Barbarian done that is heroic?" he said. "I seek only to understand."
"Well, you know their heroic deeds."
"And they are?"
"Fighting monsters, defeating tyrants, and stealing rare treasures, and rescuing maidens, that sort of thing," said Mr. Betteridge vaguely. "You know, heroic things.
"And who precisely defines the monstrousness of the monsters and the tyranny of the tyrants?" said Lord Vetinari, his voice suddenly like a scalpel, not vicious like a sword, but probing its edge into vulnerable places. Mr. Betteridge shifted uneasily.
"Well, the hero, I suppose."
"Ah, and the theft of these rare items? I think the word that interests me here is the term theft, an activity frowned on by most of the world's major religions, is it not? The feeling stealing over me is that all these terms are defined by the hero. You could say, 'I am a hero, so when I kill you, that makes you de facto the kind of person suitable to be killed by a hero.' You could say that a hero, in short, is someone who indulges every whim that, within the rule of law, would have him behind bars, or swiftly dancing what I believe is known as the hemp fandango. The words we might use are murder, pillage, theft, and rape. Have I understood the situation? Not rape, I believe, said Mr. Betteridge, finding a rock on which he could stand. Not in the case of Cohen the Barbarian. Ravishing, possibly. Is there a difference? It's more a matter of approach, I understand, said the historian. I don't believe there were ever any actual complaints.
Speaking as a lawyer, said Mr. Slant of the Guild of Lawyers, it is clear that the first ever recorded heroic deed to which the message refers was an act of theft from the rightful owners. The legends of many different cultures testify to this.
Was it something you could actually steal? Said Ridcully.
Manifestly, yes, said the lawyer. Theft is central to the legend. Fire was stolen from the gods.
This is not currently the issue, said Lord Vetinari. The issue, gentlemen, is that Cohen the Barbarian is climbing the mountain on which the gods live, and we cannot stop him. And he intends to return fire to the gods. Fire, in this case, in the shape of, let me see, Ponder Stibbons looked up from his notebooks where he had been scribbling.
A 50-pound keg of agate and thunder clay, he said. I'm amazed their wizards let him have it.
He was, indeed, I assume he still is, the Emperor, said Lord Vetinari. So I would imagine that when the supreme ruler of your continent asks you for something, it is not the time for a prudent man to ask for a docket signed by Mr. Jenkins of requisitions.
Thunderclay is terribly powerful stuff, said Ridcully, but it needs a special detonator. You have to smash a jar of acid inside the mixture. The acid soaks into it, and then kablooey, I believe the term is.
Unfortunately, the prudent man also saw fit to give one of these to Cohen, said Lord Vetinari. And if the resulting kablooey takes place atop the mountain, which is the hub of the world's magic field, it will, as I understand it, result in the field collapsing for, remind me, Mr. Stibbons,
about 2 years, he said.
Really? Well, we can do without magic for a couple of years, can't we?
Said Mr. Slant, managing to suggest that this would be a jolly good thing, too.
With respect, said Ponder, without respect, we cannot. The seas will run dry, the sun will burn out and crash, the elephants and the turtle may cease to exist altogether.
That'll happen in just 2 years?
Oh, no, that'll happen within a few minutes, sir. You see, magic isn't just coloured lights and balls. Magic holds the world together.
In the sudden silence, Lord Vetinari's voice sounded crisp and clear.
Is there anyone who knows anything about Genghis Cohen? He said. And is there anyone who can tell us why, before leaving the city, he and his men kidnapped a harmless minstrel from our embassy? Explosives, yes, very barbaric. But why a minstrel? Can anyone tell me?
There was a bitter wind this close to Corrie Celesti. From here, the World Mountain, which looked like a needle from afar, was a raw and ragged cascade of ascending peaks. The central spire was lost in a haze of snow crystals miles high. The sun sparkled on them. Several elderly men sat huddled around a fire.
"I hope he's right about the stair of light," said Boy Willie. "We're going to look real muffins if it isn't there."
"He was right about the giant walrus," said Truckle the uncivil.
"When?"
"Remember when we was crossing the ice? When he shouted, 'Look out, we're going to be attacked by a giant walrus.'"
"Oh, yeah."
Willie looked back up at the spire. The air seemed thinner already, the colours deeper, making him feel that he could reach up and touch the sky.
"Anyone know if there's a lavatory at the top?" he said.
"Oh, there's got to be," said Caleb the Ripper. "Yeah, I'm sure I heard tell about it. The toilet of the gods."
"What?"
They turned to what appeared to be a pile of furs on wheels. When the eye knew what it was looking for, this became an ancient wheelchair mounted on skis and covered with rags of blanket and animal skins. A pair of beady animal eyes peered out suspiciously from the heap. There was a barrel strapped behind the wheelchair.
"It must be time for his gruel," said Boy Willie,
putting a soot-encrusted pot on the fire.
"What?
Just warming up your gruel, Hamish? Bloody walrus again! Yes, what?"
They were, all of them, old men. Their background conversation was a litany of complaints about feet, stomachs, and backs. They moved slowly, but they had a look about them. It was in their eyes. Their eyes said that wherever it was, they had been there. Whatever it was, they had done it, sometimes more than once. But they would never, ever buy the T-shirt. And they did know the meaning of the word fear. It was something that happened to other people.
"I wish old Vincent was here,"
said Caleb the Ripper, poking the fire aimlessly.
"Well, he's gone and there's an end of it," said Truckle the Uncivil shortly. "We said we weren't going to bloody talk about it. But what a way to go. Gods, I hope that doesn't happen to me. Something like that, it shouldn't happen to anyone." "Yeah, well, right," said Truckle.
"He were a good bloke. Took everything the world threw at him."
"All right. And then to choke on... We all know. Now bloody well shut up."
"Dinner's done," said Caleb, pulling a smoking slab of grease out of the embers.
"Nice walrus steak, anyone? What about Mr. Pretty?"
They turned to an evidently human figure that had been propped against a boulder. It was indistinct because of the ropes, but it was clearly dressed in brightly coloured clothes. This wasn't the place for brightly coloured clothes. This was a land for fur and leather. Boy Willie walked over to the colourful thing.
"We'll take the gag off," he said, "if you promise not to scream."
Frantic eyes darted this way and that, and then the gagged head nodded.
"All right, then. Eat your nice walrus lump," said Boy Willie, pulling at the cloth.
"How dare you drag me all—" the minstrel began.
"Now look," said Boy Willie. "None of us like having to wallop you alongside the ear when you go on like this, do we? Be reasonable."
"Reasonable? When you kidnap—"
Boy Willie snapped the gag back into place.
"Thin streak of nothing," he muttered at the angry eyes. "You ain't even got a harp. What kind of bard doesn't even have a harp? Just this sort of little wooden pot thing. Damn silly idea."
"It's called a lute,"
said Caleb through a mouthful of walrus.
"What?" "It's called a lute, Hamish."
I used to lute."
"Nah, it's for singing posh songs for ladies," said Caleb. "About flowers and that. Romance."
The horde knew the word, although the activity had been outside the scope of their busy lives.
"Amazing what songs do for the ladies," said Caleb. "Well, when I was a lad," said Truckle, "if you wanted to get a girl's interest, you had to cut off your worst enemy's wuss name and present it to her."
"What?"
"I said, you had to cut off your worst enemy's wuss name and present it to her."
"Aye, romance is a wonderful thing," said Mad Hamish.
"What did you do if you didn't have a worst enemy?" said Boy Willie. "You try and cut off anyone's wuss name," said Truckle, "and you've soon got a worst enemy." "Flowers is more usual these days," said Caleb reflectively.
Truckle eyed the struggling lutist.
"Can't think what the boss was thinking of dragging this thing along," he said. "Where is he anyway?"
Lord Vetinari, despite his education, had a mind like an engineer. If you wished to open something, you found the appropriate spot and applied the minimum amount of force necessary to achieve your end.
Possibly the spot was between a couple of ribs, and the force was applied via a dagger, or between two warring countries and applied via an army, but the important thing was to find that one weak spot, which would be the key to everything.
"And so you are now the unpaid professor of cruel and unusual geography," he said to the figure who had been brought before him. The wizard known as Rincewind nodded slowly, just in case an admission was going to get him into trouble.
Yes.
"Have you been to the hub?"
Yes.
"Can you describe the terrain?"
What did the scenery look like?"
Lord Vetinari added helpfully.
Blurred, sir. I was being chased by some people."
"Indeed. And why was this?"
Rincewind looked shocked.
"Oh, I never stopped to find out why people are chasing me, sir. I never looked behind, either. That'd be rather silly, sir."
Lord Vetinari pinched the bridge of his nose.
"Just tell me what you know about Cohen, please," he said wearily.
"Him? Why, just a hero who never died, sir. A leathery old man, not very bright, really. But he's got so much cunning and guile you'd never know it."
"Are you a friend of his?"
"Well, we've met a couple of times and he didn't kill me," said Rincewind. "That probably counts as a yes."
"And what about the old men who are with him?"
"Oh, they're not old men. Well, yes, they are old men, but, well, they're his silver hoard, sir."
"Those are the silver hoard? All of it?"
"Yes, sir," said Rincewind.
"But I thought the silver hoard conquered the entire Agatian Empire."
"Yes, sir, that was them."
Rincewind shook his head.
"I know it's hard to believe, sir, but you haven't seen them fight. They're experienced, and the thing is, the big thing about Cohen is, he's contagious."
"You mean he's a plague carrier?"
"It's like a mental illness, sir, or magic. He's as crazy as a stoat, but once they've been around him for a while, people start seeing the world the way he does, all big and simple, and they want to be part of it."
Lord Vetinari looked at his fingernails.
"But I understood that those men had settled down and were immensely rich and powerful," he said. "That's what heroes want, isn't it? To crush the thrones of the world beneath their sandaled feet, as the poet puts it."
"Yes, sir."
"So, what's this? One last throw of the dice? Why?"
"I can't understand it, sir. I mean, they had it all."
"Clearly," said the patrician. "But everything wasn't enough, was it?"
There was an argument in the anteroom beyond the patrician's oblong office. Every few minutes, a clerk slipped in through a side door and laid another pile of papers on the desk. Lord Vetinari stared at them. Possibly, he felt, the thing to do would be to wait until the pile of international advice and demands grew as tall as Corrie Celesti and simply climb to the top of it. Zip, zing, and can do, he thought.
"So, as a man full of get-up-and-go must do," Lord Vetinari got up and went.
He unlocked a secret door in the panelling and a moment later was gliding silently through the hidden corridors of his palace. The dungeons of the palace held a number of felons imprisoned at his lordship's pleasure, and since Lord Vetinari was seldom very pleased, they were generally in for the long haul. His destination now, though, was the strangest prisoner of all, who lived in the attic.